Malcolm sighed. "That guy," he said, "is starting to get on my nerves." Thorne moved down the trailer to the communications module near the front. Levine's request was odd. There was a perfectly good system of microphones throughout the trailer. But Levine knew that. He had designed the system himself. Thorne picked up the phone. "Yes?" "Doc," Levine said, "I'll get right to the point. Bringing the baby to the trailer was a mistake. It's asking for trouble."
"What sort of trouble?"
"We don't know, is the point. And I don't want to alarm anybody. But why don't you bring the kids out to the High Hide for a while? And why don't you and Eddie come, too?"
"You're telling me to get the hell out of here. You really think it's necessary?"
"In a word," Levine said, "yes, I do." As the morphine was injected into the baby, he gave a sighing wheeze and collapsed back onto the steel pan. Sarah adjusted the oxygen mask around his face. She glanced back at the monitor, checking the heart rate, but once again Arby and Kelly were blocking her view.
"Kids, please."
Thorne stepped forward, clapped his hands.
"Okay, kids. Field trip. Let's get moving."
Arby said,
"Now? But we want to watch the baby."
"No, no," Thorne said. "Dr. Malcolm and Dr. Harding need room to work. This is the time for a field trip to the High Hide. We can watch the dinosaurs for the rest of the afternoon."
"But, Doc..."
"Don't argue. We're just in the way here and we're going," Thorne said. "Eddie, you come too. Leave these two lovebirds to do their work." In a few moments, they left. The trailer door slammed shut behind them. Sarah Harding heard the soft whir of the Explorer as it drove away. Bent over the baby, adjusting the oxygen mask, she said,
"Lovebirds?"
Malcolm shrugged.
"Levine."
Was this Levine's idea? Clearing everybody out?
Probably.
"Does he know something we don't?"
Malcolm laughed.
"I'm sure he thinks he does."
"Well, let's start the cast," she said.
"I want to get it done quickly and take this baby home again.
The High Hide." The sun had disappeared behind low-hanging clouds by the time they reached the High Hide. The entire valley was bathed in a soft, reddish glow as Eddie parked the Explorer beneath the aluminum scaffolding, and they all climbed up to the little shelter above. Levine was there, binoculars to his eyes. He did not seem glad to see them.
"Stop moving around so much," he said irritably.
From the shelter, they had a magnificent view over the valley. Somewhere in the north, thunder rumbled. The air was cooling and felt electric.
"Is there going to be a storm?" Kelly asked.
"Looks like it," Thorne said. Arby glanced doubtfully at the metal roof of the shelter.
"How long are we staying out here?"
"For a while," Thorne said. "This is our only day here. The helicopters are taking us away tomorrow morning. I thought you kids deserved a chance to see the dinosaurs in the field one more time." Arby squinted at him.
"What's the real reason?"
"I know," Kelly said in a worldly tone.
"Yeah?
What?"
"Dr. Malcolm wants to be alone with Sarah, stupid."
"Why?"
"They're old friends," Kelly said.
"So? We were just going to watch."
"No," Kelly said. "I mean, they're old friends."
"I know what you're talking about," Arby said. "I'm not stupid, you know." "Knock it off," Levine said, staring through the binoculars. "You're missing the interesting stuff."
"What's that?"
"Those triceratops down at the river. Something's bothering them." The triceratops herd had been drinking peacefully from the river, but now they were beginning to make noise. For such huge animals, their vocalizations were incongruously high-pitched. They sounded more like yelping dogs. Arby turned to look.
There's something in the trees, he said, across the river. There was some hint of dark movement beneath the trees.
The Triceratops herd shifted and began backing toward each other until they formed a sort of rosette, with their curved horns facing outward against the unseen menace. The solitary baby was in the center, yelping in fear. One of the animals, presumably its mother, turned and nuzzled it. Afterward, the baby was silent.
I see them, Kelly said, staring at the trees. They're raptors. Over there.
The Triceratops herd faced the raptors, the adults barking as they swung their sharp horns up and down. They created a kind of barrier of moving spikes. There was an unmistakable sense of coordination, of group defense against predators. Levine was smiling happily.
There's never been any evidence for this, he said, suddenly cheerful.
In fact, most paleontologists don't believe it happens.
Don't believe what happens, Arby said.
This kind of group defensive behavior. Especially with trikes. They look a bit like rhinos, so they've been assumed to be solitary like rhinos.
But now we will see.
Ah. Yes.
From beneath the trees, a single velociraptor hopped out into view. It moved quickly on its hind legs, balancing with a stiff tail. The Triceratops herd barked noisily at the appearance of the raptor. The other raptors remained hidden beneath the trees. The solitary velociraptor in full view moved in a slow semicircle around the herd, entering the water on the far side. It crossed, swimming easily, and came out on the other bank. It was now about 50 yards upstream from the barking Triceratops herd, which wheeled to present a united front. All their attention was focused on the single velociraptor. Slowly, other raptors began to slink out of their hiding place. They moved low, bodies hidden in the tall grass. Jeez, Arby said. They're hunting.
In a pack, Levine said, nodding. He picked up a bit of candy bar wrapper from the floor of the shelter and dropped it, watching it flutter off in the wind. The main pack is downwind, so the trikes can't smell them. He raised the binoculars to his eyes again.
I think, he said, that we're about to see a kill.
They watched as the raptors closed in around the herd. And then suddenly, lightning cracked on the island rim, brilliantly lighting the valley floor. One of the stalking raptors stood up in surprise. Its head was briefly visible above the grass. Immediately, the Triceratops herd wheeled again, regrouping to face the new menace. All the raptors stopped, as if to reconsider their plan.
What happened? Arby said. Why are they stopping?
They're in trouble.
Why?
Look at them. The main pack is still across the river. They're too far away to mount an attack.
You mean they're giving up?
Already?
Looks like it, Levine said.
One by one, the raptors in the grass raised their heads, making their positions known. As each new predator appeared, the Triceratops barked loudly. The raptors seemed to know the situation was hopeless. They slunk away, moving back toward the trees. Seeing them retreat, the Triceratops barked even louder. And then the single raptor by the water's edge charged. It moved incredibly fast, astonishingly fast, streaking like a cheetah across the 50 yards that separated it from the herd. The adult Triceratops had no time to reform. The baby was exposed. It squealed in fright as it saw the approaching animal. The Velociraptor leapt into the air, raising both its hind legs. Lightning cracked again, and in the brilliant light they saw the twin curved claws high in the air. At the last moment, the nearest adult turned, swiveling its big horned head with the wide bony crest, and it knocked the raptor a glancing blow, sending the animal sprawling on the muddy bank. Immediately, the adult Triceratops charged forward, its head high. When it reached the raptor, it stopped abruptly and swung its big head down, lowering its horns toward the fallen animal. But the raptor was quick. Hissing, it leapt to its feet, and the Triceratops' horns slashed harmlessly into the mud. The raptor spun sideways and kicked the adult on the snout, drawing blood with its big, curved claw. The adult bellowed, but by then two other adults were charging forward, while the others remained behind with the baby. The raptor scrambled away, back into the grass.
"Wow," Arby said. "That was something."
The herd. King gave a long sigh of relief as he came to the Y-fork in the road and drove the red jeep left, coming onto a wide dirt road. He recognized it at once. This was the ridge road that led back to the boat. As he looked off to his left, he could see down across the East Valley. The boat was still there. All right. He gave a shout and accelerated sharply, relief flooding through him. On the deck, he could see the Spanish fishermen staring up at the sky. Despite the threatening storm, they didn't seem to be preparing to leave. Probably they were waiting for Dodgson. Well, he thought, that was fine. King would be there in a few minutes. After working his way through dense jungle, he could finally see exactly where he was. The ridge road was high, following the crest of one of the volcanic spines. There was almost no foliage up here, and as the road twisted and turned, he had views across the entire island. To the east, he could look down into the ravine and the boat at the shore. To the west, he could look straight across at the laboratory and Malcolm's twin trailers parked near the far edge of the clearing. They never did find out what the hell Malcolm was doing here, he thought. Not that it mattered now. King was getting off the island. That was the only thing that mattered. He could almost feel the deck beneath his feet. Maybe one of the fishermen would even have a beer. A nice cold beer, while they chugged down the river and pulled out of this damn island. He'd toast Dodgson, is what he'd do. Maybe, he thought, I'll have two beers. King came around a curve and saw a herd of animals standing thickly in the road. They were some kind of green dinosaurs, about 4 feet tall, with big domed heads and a bunch of little horns. They reminded him of green water buffalo. But there were a lot of them. He braked sharply. The car swerved to a stop. The green dinosaurs looked at his car, but they did not move. The herd just stood there in a lazy, contented way. King waited, drumming his fingers on the steering wheel. When nothing happened, he honked the horn and flashed his headlights. The animals just stared. They were funny-looking creatures, with that smooth, bulging curve on the forehead and all those little horns around it. They just stared at him with a stupid, cow-like look. He slipped the car into gear and edged it forward slowly, expecting that he could push his way through the animals. They didn't move aside. Finally, his front bumper nudged the nearest animal, which grunted, took a couple of steps back, lowered its head, and butted the front of the car, hard, with a metallic clang. Christ, he thought. It could puncture the radiator if he wasn't careful. He stopped the car again and waited. The motor idling. The animals settled down again. Several of them lay down on the road. He couldn't drive over them. He looked ahead toward the river and saw the boat, not more than a quarter of a mile away. He hadn't realized it was so near. As he watched, he realized that the fishermen were very busy on the deck. They were swinging the crane back, lashing it down. They were getting ready to leave. The hell with waiting, he thought. He opened the door and climbed out, leaving the car in the center of the road. Immediately, the animals jumped to their feet, and the nearest one charged him. He had the door open. The animal smashed into it, slamming it shut, leaving a deep dent in the metal. King scrambled toward the edge of the hill, only to find he was at the top of a steep, vertical descent of more than 100 feet. He'd never make it down, at least not here. Farther along, the slope was not so steep.
but now more animals were charging him. He had no choice. He ran around the back of the car just as another animal smashed into the rear taillight, shattering the plastic. A third animal charged the back of the car directly. King scrambled up onto the spare tire as the animal slammed into the bumper. The jolt knocked him off, and he fell to the ground, rolling, while the buffaloes snorted all around him. He got to his feet and ran to the opposite side of the road, where there was a slight rise. He scrambled up it, moving into foliage. The animals did not pursue him. Not that it did him any good. Now he was on the wrong side of the road. Somehow, he had to get back to the other side. He climbed to the top of the rise and started down, swearing to himself. He decided to work his way forward 100 yards or so until he was beyond the butting animals and then cross the road. If he could do that, then he could get to the boat. Almost immediately, he was surrounded by dense jungle. He tripped, tumbled down a muddy slope, and when he got to his feet, was no longer sure which way to go. He was at the bottom of a ravine, and the palm trees were 10 feet tall and very thick. He couldn't see more than a few feet in any direction. In a moment of panic, he realized he didn't know which way to go. He pushed forward through the wet leaves, hoping to get his bearings back. The kids were still peering over the railing, looking at the departing raptors. Thorne pulled Levine to one side and said quietly, "Why did you want us to come here?" "Just precaution," Levine said. "Bringing the infant to the trailer is asking for trouble." "What sort of trouble?" Levine shrugged. "We don't know is the point. But in general, parents don't like it when their babies are taken away. And that baby has some very big parents." From the other side of the shelter, Arby said, "Look, look!" "What is it?" Levine said.
"It's a man."
Gasping for breath, King emerged from the jungle and walked out onto the plain. At last he could see where he was. He paused, soaked and muddy, to get his bearings. He was disappointed to find that he was nowhere near the boat. In fact, he still seemed to be on the wrong side of the road. He was facing a broad, grassy plain with a river coursing through it. The plain was mostly deserted, although there were several dinosaurs farther down the banks. They were the horned ones, Triceratops, and they looked a little agitated. The big adults were raising their heads up and down, making barking sounds. Obviously, he would have to follow the river until it brought him to the boat. But he'd have to be careful getting past these Triceratops. He reached in his pocket and pulled out a candy bar. He ripped the wrapping while he watched the Triceratops, wishing they would go away. How long would it take him to reach the boat? That was the only question on his mind. He decided to move, Triceratops or not. He began walking through the tall grass. Then he heard a reptilian hiss. It was coming from the grass, somewhere to his left. And he noticed a smell, a peculiar, rotten smell. He paused, waiting. The candy bar didn't taste so good anymore. Then behind him, he heard splashing. It was coming from the river. King turned to look. "It's one of those men from the jeep," Arby said, standing in the high hide. "But why is he waiting?" From their vantage point, they could see the dark shapes of the raptors moving through the grass on the other side of the river. Now 2 of the raptors came forward, splashing in the water, moving toward the man. "Oh, no," Arby said. King saw 2 dark, striped lizards moving across the river. They walked on their hind legs with a sort of hopping motion. Their bodies were reflected in the flowing water of the river. They snapped their long jaws and hissed menacingly at King. He glanced upstream and saw another lizard crossing, and another beyond that. Those other animals were already deep in the water and had begun to swim.
Howard King backed away from the river, moving deeper into the tall grass. Then he turned and ran. He was chest deep in grass and running hard, gasping for breath, when suddenly another lizard head rose up in front of him, hissing and snarling. He dodged, changed direction, but suddenly the nearest lizard leapt in the air. It jumped so high its body cleared the grass. He could see the entire animal flying through the air, its two hind legs raised to pounce. He glimpsed curved, dagger-like claws. King turned again, and the lizard shrieked as it landed on the ground behind him and tumbled away in the grass. King ran on. He was energized by pure fear. Behind him, he heard the lizard snarling. He ran hard. Ahead was another 20 yards of grassy clearing, and then the jungle began again. He saw trees, big trees. He could climb one and get away. Off to the left, he saw another lizard moving diagonally across the clearing toward him. King could only see the head above the grass. The lizard seemed to be moving incredibly fast. He thought, "I'm not going to make it." But he would try. Panting, lungs searing, he sprinted for the trees. Only 10 more yards now. His arms pumped, his legs churned. His breath came in ragged gasps. And then something heavy struck him from behind, forcing him to the ground, and he felt searing pain down his back, and he knew it was the claws. They dug into the flesh of his back as he was knocked down. He hit the dirt hard and tried to roll, but the animal on his back held on. He could not move. He was pinned down on his stomach, hearing the animal snarl behind him. The pain in his back was excruciating, dizzying. And then he felt the animal's hot breath on the back of his neck, and he heard the snorting breath, and his terror was extreme. Then suddenly, a kind of lassitude, a deep and welcome sleepiness took him. Everything became slow. As if in a dream, he could see all the blades of grass in the ground in front of his face. He saw them with a kind of languid intensity, and he almost did not mind the sharp pain on his neck, and he almost did not care that his neck was within the animal's hot jaws. It seemed to be happening to someone else. He was many miles away. He had a moment of surprise when he felt the bones of his neck crunching loudly, and then blackness. Nothing. "Don't look," Thorne said, turning Arby away from the railing in the high hide. He drew the boy toward his chest, but Arby impatiently pushed away again to watch what was happening. Thorne reached for Kelly, but she stepped away from him and stared out at the plain. "Don't look," Thorne kept saying. "Don't look." The kids watched in silence. Levine focused his binoculars on the kill. There were now 5 raptors snarling around the man's body, tearing viciously at the carcass. As he watched, one of the raptors jerked its head up, tearing away a piece of blood-soaked shirt, the ragged edge of the collar. Another was shaking the man's severed head in its jaws before finally dropping it on the ground. Thunder rumbled and lightning flashed in the distant sky. It was growing dark, and Levine was having difficulty seeing exactly what was happening. But it was clear that whatever hierarchical organization they had adopted for hunting was abandoned for a kill. Here it was every animal for itself. The frenzied raptors hopped and ducked their heads as they tore the body to pieces, and there was plenty of nipping and fighting among themselves. One animal came up, with something brown hanging from its jaws. The animal got an odd expression on its face as it chewed. Then it turned away from the rest of the pack and held the brown object carefully in its forearms. In the growing darkness, it took Levine a moment to recognize what it was doing. It was eating a candy bar, and it seemed to be enjoying it. The raptor turned back and buried its long nose in the bloody carcass again. From across the plain, other raptors were racing to join the feast, half running, half bounding in great forward leaps. Snarling and furious, they threw themselves into the fray. Levine lowered his glasses and looked at the two kids. They were staring silently and calmly at the kill. Dodgson. Dodgson was awakened by a noisy chittering, like the sound of 100 tiny birds. It seemed to be coming from all around him. Slowly, he realized that he was lying on his back, on damp, sloping ground. He tried to move, but his body felt painful and heavy. Some sort of weight pressed down on his legs, his stomach, his arms. The weight on his chest made it difficult to breathe. And he was sleepy, incredibly sleepy. He wanted nothing more in all the world than to go back to sleep. Dodgson started to drift off to unconsciousness, but something was pulling at his hand, tugging at his fingers one by one, as if pulling him back to consciousness. Slowly, slowly pulling him back. Dodgson opened his eyes. There was a little green dinosaur standing beside his hand. It leaned over and bit his finger in its tiny jaws, tugging at the flesh. His fingers were bleeding. Ragged chunks of flesh had already been bitten away. He pulled his hand away in surprise, and suddenly the chittering grew louder. He turned and saw that he was surrounded by these little dinosaurs. They were standing on his chest and legs as well. They were the size of chickens, and they pecked at him like chickens, quick darting bites on his stomach, his thighs, his crotch. Revolted, Dodgson jumped to his feet, scattering the lizards, which hopped away, chirping in annoyance. The little animals moved a few feet away, then stopped. They turned back and stared at him, showing no sign of fear. On the contrary, they seemed to be waiting. That was when he realized what they were. They were procompsognathids, compies, scavengers. Christ, he thought. They thought I was dead. He staggered back, almost losing his balance. He felt pain and a wave of dizziness. The little animals chittered, watched his every move. Go on, he said, waving his hand. Get out of here. They did not leave. They stood there, cocking their heads to one side quizzically, and waited. He bent his head, stared down at himself. His shirt, his trousers were torn in 100 places. Blood dribbled from 100 tiny wounds down his clothes. He felt a wave of dizziness and put his hands on his knees. He took a deep breath and watched his blood drip onto the leaf-strewn ground. Christ, he thought. He took another deep breath. When he did not move, the animals began to inch forward. He stood up, and they backed away. But a moment later, they began to come forward again. One came close. Dodgson kicked it viciously, sending the little body flying through the air. The animal squealed in alarm, but it landed like a cat, upright and uninjured. The others remained where they were, waiting. He looked around, realized it was getting dark. He looked at his watch. 6:40. There were only a few minutes more of daylight. Beneath the jungle canopy, it was already quite dark. He had to get to safety, and soon. He checked the compass on his watch strap and headed south. He was pretty sure the river was to the south. He had to get back to the boat. He would be safe at the boat. As he started walking, the compies chittered and followed after him. They stayed about 5 or 10 feet behind, making a lot of noise as they hopped and crashed through the low foliage. There were dozens of them, he realized. As darkness descended, their eyes glowed bright green. His body was a mass of pain. Every step hurt.
His balance was not good. He was losing blood, and he was very, very sleepy. He would never make it all the way to the river. He would not make it more than another couple of hundred yards. He fell, tripping over a root. He got up slowly, dirt clinging to his blood-soaked clothes. He looked back at the green eyes behind him and forced himself onward. He could go a little farther, he thought. And then, directly ahead, he saw a light through the foliage. Was it the boat? He moved faster, hearing the compies behind him. He pushed through the foliage and then saw a little shed, like a tool shed or a guardhouse made of concrete with a tin roof. It had a square window, and light was shining through the window. He fell again, got to his knees, and crawled the rest of the way to the house. He reached the door, pulled himself up on the doorknob, and opened the door. Inside, the shed was empty. Some pipes came up through the floor. Some time in the past, they had connected to machinery, but the machinery was gone. There were only the rust spots where it had once been bolted to the concrete floor. In a corner of the room was an electric light. It was fitted with a timer so that it came on at night. That was the light he had seen. Did they have electricity on this island? How? He didn't care. He staggered into the room, closed the door firmly behind him, and sank down onto the bare concrete. Through the dirty window panes, he saw the compies outside, banging against the glass, hopping in frustration. But he was safe for the moment. He would have to go on, of course. He would somehow have to get off this fucking island. But not now, he thought. Later. He'd worry about everything later. Dodgson laid his cheek on the damp concrete floor and slept. Trailer. Sarah Harding placed the aluminum foil cuff around the baby's injured leg. The baby was still unconscious, breathing easily, not moving. Its body was relaxed. The oxygen hissed softly. She finished shaping the aluminum foil into a cuff 6 inches long. Using a small brush, she began to paint resin over it to make a cast. "How many raptors are there?" she said. "I couldn't tell for sure when I saw them. I thought 9. "I think there's more," Malcolm said. "I think 11 or 12 in all." 12, she said, glancing up at him. "On this little island?" "Yes." The resin had a sharp odor, like glue. She brushed it evenly on the aluminum. "You know what I'm thinking," she said. "Yes," he said. "There are too many. Far too many, Ian." She worked steadily. "It doesn't make sense. In Africa, active predators like lions are very spread out. There's one lion for every 10 square kilometers. Sometimes every 15 kilometers. That's all the ecology can support. On an island like this, you should have no more than 5 raptors. Hold this." "Uh-huh. But don't forget, the prey here is huge. Some of those animals are 20-30 tons. "I'm not convinced that's a factor," Sarah said. "But for the sake of argument, let's say it is. I'll double the estimate and give you 10 raptors for the island. But you tell me there are 12. And there are other major predators as well. Like the rexes." "Yes, there are." "That's too many," she said, shaking her head. "The animals are pretty dense here," Malcolm said. "Not dense enough," she said. "In general, predator studies, whether tigers in India or lions in Africa, all seem to show that you can support one predator for every 200 prey animals. That means to support 25 predators here, you need at least 5,000 prey on this island. Do you have anything like that?" "No." "How many animals in total do you think are here?" He shrugged. "A couple of 100. Maybe 500 at most.
So you're off by an order of magnitude, Ian.
Hold this, and I'll get the lamp.
She swung the heat lamp over the baby to harden the resin. She adjusted the oxygen mask over the baby's snout.
The island can't support all those predators, she said. And yet, they're here.
He said, what could explain it? She shook her head.
There has to be a food source that we don't know about.
You mean an artificial source? He said.
I don't think there is one.
No, she said. Artificial food sources make animals tame. And these animals aren't tame. The only other possibility I can think of is that there's a differential death rate among prey. If they grow very fast or die young, then that might represent a larger food supply than expected.
Malcolm said, I've noticed the largest animals seem small. It's as if they don't seem to reach maturity. Maybe they're being killed off early.
Maybe, she said. But if there's a differential death rate large enough to support this population, you should see evidence of carcasses and lots of skeletons of dead animals.
Have you seen that?
Malcolm shook his head.
No. In fact, now that you mention it, I haven't seen any skeletons at all.
Me neither.
She pushed the light away.
There's something funny about this island, Ian.
I know, Malcolm said.
You do?
Yes, he said. I've suspected it from the beginning.
Thunder rumbled. From the high hide, the plain below them was dark and silent, except for the distant snarling of the raptors.
Maybe we should go back, Eddie said anxiously.
Why?
Levine said.
Levine had switched to his night vision glasses, pleased with himself that he had thought to bring them. Through the goggles, the world was shades of pale green. He clearly saw the raptors at the kill site, the tall grass trampled and bloody all around. The carcass was long since finished, though they could still hear the cracking of bones as the animals gnawed on them.
I just think, Eddie said, now that it's night, we'd be safer in the trailer.
Why? Levine said.
Well, it's reinforced. It's strong and very safe. It has everything that we need. I just think we should be there. I mean, you're not planning on staying out here all night, are you?
No, Levine said.
What do you think I am, a fanatic?
Eddie grunted.
But let's stay for a while longer, Levine said.
Eddie turned to Thorne.
Doc, what do you say?
It's going to start raining soon.
Just a little longer, Thorne said, and then we'll all go back together.
There have been dinosaurs on this island for 5 years. Maybe more, Malcolm said. But none have appeared elsewhere. Suddenly, in the last year, carcasses of dead animals are showing up on the beaches of Costa Rica, and according to reports, on islands of the Pacific as well.
Carried by currents?
Presumably.
But the question is, why now?
Why all of a sudden, after 5 years?
Something has changed, but we don't know.
Wait a minute. He moved away from the table, over to the computer console. He turned toward the screen.
What are you doing? She said.
Arby got us into the old network, he said, and it still has research files from the 80s. He moved the mouse across the screen.
We haven't looked at them.
He saw the menu come up, showing work files and research files. He began to scroll through screens of text.
Years ago, they had trouble with some disease, he said. There were a lot of notes about it in the laboratory.
What kind of disease?
They didn't know, Malcolm said.
In the wild, there are some very slow-acting illnesses, she said.
May take 5 or 10 years to show up.
Caused by viruses or prions.
You know, protein fragments. Like scrapie or mad cow disease.
But, Malcolm said,
Those diseases only come from eating contaminated food. There was a silence.
What do you suppose they fed them back then? She asked.
Because if I was growing baby dinosaurs, I'd wonder.
What do they eat?
Milk, I suppose, but...
Milk, yes, Malcolm said, reading the screens. First 6 weeks, goat's milk.
That's the logical choice, she said. Goat's milk is what they always use in zoos because it's so hypoallergenic.
But what about later?
Give me a minute here, Malcolm said. Harding held the baby's leg in her hand, waiting for the resin to harden. She looked at the cast, sniffed it. It was still strong-smelling.
I hope that's all right, she said.
Sometimes if there's a distinctive smell, the animals won't allow infants to return. But maybe this will dissipate after the compound hardens.
How long has it been?
Malcolm glanced at his watch. 10 minutes. Another 10 minutes and it'll set. She said,
I'd like to take this guy back to the nest.
Thunder rumbled. They looked out the window at the black night. Probably too late to return him tonight, Malcolm said. He was still typing, peering at the screen. So, what did they feed them? Okay. In the period from 1988 to 1989, the herbivores got a macerated plant matter on a feeding schedule 3 times a day, and the carnivores got... He stopped.
What did the carnivores get?
Looks like a ground-up extract of animal protein.
From what?
The usual source is turkey or chicken with some antibiotics added. Sarah, he said, they used sheep extract.
No, she said. They wouldn't do that.
Yeah, they did. Came from their supplier, who used ground-up sheep.
You're kidding, she said.
Malcolm said, I'm afraid so. Now let me see if I can find out. A soft alarm sounded. On the wall panel above him, a red light began to flash. A moment later, the exterior lights above the trailer turned on, bathing the grassy clearing around them in bright halogen glare.
What's that? Harding said.
The sensors. Something set them off. Malcolm moved away from the computer, peered out the window. He saw nothing but tall grass and the dark trees at the perimeter. It was silent, still. Sarah, still intent on the baby, said,
What happened?
I don't know. I don't see anything.
But something triggered the sensors?
I guess.
Wind?
There's no wind, he said. In the high hide, Kelly said,
Hey, look!
Thorn turned. From their location in the valley, they could look north to the high cliff behind them and the 2 trailers above in the grassy clearing. The exterior lights on the trailers had come on. Thorn unclipped the radio at his belt. Ian? Are you there? A momentary crackle. I'm here, Doc.
What's happening?
I don't know, Malcolm said. The perimeter lights just turned on. I think the sensor was activated. But we don't see anything out there. Eddie said, Air's cooling off fast now.
Might have been convection currents set it off.
Thorne said, Ian, everything okay?
Yes, fine. Don't worry.
Eddie said, I always figured we set the sensitivity too high. That's all it is. Levine frowned and said nothing. Sarah finished with the baby and wrapped him in a blanket and gently strapped him down to the table with cloth restraint straps. She came over and stood beside Malcolm. She looked out the window.
What do you think?
Malcolm shrugged. Eddie says the system's too sensitive.
Is it?
I don't know. It's never been tested before. He scanned the trees at the edge of the clearing, looking for any movement. Then he thought he heard a snorting sound, almost a growl. It seemed like it was answered from somewhere behind him. He went to look out the other side of the trailer, at the trees on the other side. Malcolm and Harding looked out, straining to see something in the night. Malcolm held his breath, tensely. After a moment, Harding sighed.
I don't see anything, Ian.
No. Me neither.
Must be a false alarm.
Then he felt the vibration, a deep, resonant thumping in the ground that was carried to them through the floor of the trailer. He glanced at Sarah. Her eyes widened. Malcolm knew what it was. The vibration came again, unmistakably this time. Sarah stared out the window. She whispered,
Ian, I see it.
Malcolm turned and joined her. She was pointing out the window toward the nearest trees. What? And then he saw the big head emerge from the foliage midway up one tree. The head turned slowly from side to side, as if listening. It was an adult Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Ian, she whispered. Look, there are two of them.
Over to the right, he saw a second animal step from behind the trees. It was larger, the female of the pair. The animals growled, a deep rumble in the night. They emerged slowly from the cover of the trees, stepping into the clearing. They blinked in the harsh light.
Are those the parents?
I don't know. I think so. He glanced over at the baby. It was still unconscious, breathing steadily, the blanket rising and falling regularly.
What are they doing here? She said.
I don't know. The animals were still standing at the edge of the clearing, near the cover of the trees. They seemed hesitant, waiting.
Are they looking for the baby? She said.
Sarah, please.
I'm serious.
That's ridiculous.
Why? They must have tracked it here.
The tyrannosaurs raised their heads, lifting their jaws. Then they turned their heads left and right in slow arcs. They repeated the movement, then took a step forward, toward the trailer. Sarah, he said, we're miles from the nest. There isn't any way for them to track it.
How do you know?
Sarah.
You said yourself, we don't know anything about these animals. We don't know anything about their physiology, their biochemistry, their nervous systems, their behavior. And we don't know anything about their sensory equipment either.
Yes, but
they're predators, Ian. Good sense of vision, good sense of hearing and smell.
I assume so, yes.
But we don't know what else, Sarah said.
What else? Malcolm said.
Ian.
There are other sensory modalities. Snakes sense infrared. Bats have echolocation. Birds and turtles have magnetosensors. They can detect the Earth's magnetic field, which is how they migrate. Dinosaurs may have other sensory modalities that we can't imagine.
Sarah, this is ridiculous.
Is it?
Then you tell me. What are they doing out there?
Outside, near the trees, the tyrannosaurs had become silent. They were no longer growling, but they were still moving their heads back and forth in slow arcs, turning left and right. Malcolm frowned. It looks like they're looking around. Straight into bright lights?
No, Ian. They're blinded.
As soon as she said it, he realized she was right. But the heads were turning back and forth in that regular way. Then what are they doing? Smelling?
No. Heads are high. Nostrils aren't moving.
Listening?
She nodded. Possibly.
Listening to what?
Maybe to the baby.
He glanced over again. Sarah, the baby is out cold.
I know.
It isn't making any noise.
None that we can hear.
She stared at the tyrannosaurs. But they're doing something, Ian. That behavior we're seeing has meaning. We just don't know what it is.
From the high hide, Levine stared through his night vision glasses at the clearing. He saw the two tyrannosaurs standing at the edge of the forest. They were moving their heads in an odd, synchronized way. They took a few hesitant steps toward the trailer, lifted their heads, turned right and left, and then seemed finally to make up their minds. The animals moved quickly, almost aggressively, across the clearing. Over the radio, they heard Malcolm say,
"It's the lights! The lights are drawing them!"
A moment later, the exterior lights were turned off, and the clearing went black. They all squinted in the darkness. They heard Malcolm say,
"That did it."
Thorne said to Levine, "What do you see?"
"Nothing."
"What are they doing?"
"They're just standing there."
Through the night vision goggles, he saw that the tyrannosaurs had paused, as if confused by this change in light. Even from a distance, he could hear their growls, but they were uneasy. They swung their great heads up and down and snapped their jaws, but they did not move closer. Kelly said,
"What is it?"
"They're waiting," Levine said, "at least for the moment." Levine had the distinct impression that the tyrannosaurs were unsettled. The trailer must represent a large and fearsome change in their environment. Perhaps they would turn away, he thought, and leave. Despite their enormous size, they were cautious, almost timid animals. They growled again, and then he saw them move forward toward the darkened trailer.
"Ian, what do we do?"
"Damned if I know," Malcolm whispered. They were crouched down side by side in the passageway, trying to stay out of sight in the windows. The tyrannosaurs moved implacably forward. They could feel each step as a distinct vibration now. 2 10-ton animals moving toward them.
"They're coming right at us."
"I noticed," he said. The first of the animals reached the trailer, coming so close that the body blocked the entire window. All Malcolm could see was powerfully muscled legs and underbelly. The head was far above them, out of view. Then the second tyrannosaur came up on the opposite side. The two animals began to circle the trailer, growling and snorting. Heavy footsteps shook the floor beneath them. They smelled the pungent predator odor. One of the tyrannosaurs brushed against the side of the trailer, and they heard a scraping sound, scaly flesh on metal. Malcolm felt sudden panic. It was the smell that did it. The smell that he suddenly remembered from before. He began to sweat. He glanced over at Sarah and saw that she was intent, watching the movements of the animals.
"This isn't hunting behavior," she whispered.
"I don't know," Malcolm said. "Maybe it is. They aren't lions, you know." One of the tyrannosaurs bellowed in the night, a frightening, ear-splitting sound.
"Not hunting," she said. "They're searching, Ian."
A moment later, the second tyrannosaur bellowed in reply. Then the big head swung down and peered in through the window in front of them. Malcolm ducked down, flattening himself on the trailer floor, and Sarah collapsed on top of him. Her shoe pressed on his ear.
"It's going to be fine, Sarah."
Outside, they heard the tyrannosaurs snorting and growling. Malcolm whispered,
"Would you mind moving?"
She edged to one side and he eased up slowly, peering cautiously over the seat cushions. He had a glimpse of the big eye of the Rex staring in at him. The eye swiveled in the socket. He saw the jaws open and close. The hot breath of the animal fogged the glass. The tyrannosaur's head swung away, moving back from the trailer, and for a moment Malcolm breathed more easily. But then the head swung back and slammed with a heavy thud into the trailer, rocking it hard.
"Don't worry, Sarah.
The trailer's very strong." She whispered,
"I can't tell you how relieved I am." From the opposite side, the other Rex bellowed and struck the trailer with its snout. The suspension creaked with the impact. The two Tyrannosaurs now began an alternating, rhythmic pounding of the trailer from either side. Malcolm and Harding were thrown back and forth. Sarah tried to steady herself, but was knocked away at the next impact. The floor tilted crazily under each blow. Lab equipment flew off the tables. Glass shattered. And then, abruptly, the pounding stopped. There was silence. Grunting, Malcolm got up on one knee. He peered out the window and saw the hindquarters of one of the Tyrannosaurs as it moved forward. "What do we do?" he whispered. The radio crackled. Thorne said, "Ian, are you there?" "Ian!"
"For God's sake, turn that off," Sarah whispered.
Malcolm reached for his belt, whispered, "We're okay," and clicked the radio off. Sarah was crawling on her hands and knees forward through the trailer into the biology lab. He followed her and saw the big Tyrannosaur peering in through the window at the baby strapped down. The Tyrannosaur made a soft grunting sound. Then it paused, looking in the window. It grunted again.
"She wants her baby, Ian," Sarah whispered.
"Well, God knows," Malcolm said. "It's all right with me." They were huddled on the floor, trying to stay out of sight.
"How are we going to get it to her?"
"I don't know. Maybe push it out the door?"
"I don't want them to step on it," Sarah said.
"Who cares?" Malcolm said. The Tyrannosaur at the window made a series of soft grunts, followed by a long, menacing growl. It was the big female. "Sarah." But she was already standing up, facing the Tyrannosaur. She immediately began to speak, her voice soft, soothing.
"It's okay. It's all right now. The baby is fine. I'm just going to loosen these straps here. You can watch me."
The head outside the window was so huge it filled the entire glass frame. Sarah saw the powerful muscles of the neck ripple beneath the skin. The jaws moved slightly. Her hands trembled as she undid the straps.
"That's right. Your baby is fine. See?
It's just fine." Crouched below at her feet, Malcolm whispered,
"What are you doing?"
She did not change her soft, soothing tone.
"I know it sounds crazy, but it works with lions. Sometimes. There we are. Your baby is free."
Sarah unwrapped the blanket and took away the oxygen mask, all the while speaking calmly.
"Now, all I have to do,"
she lifted the baby up in her hands,
"is get it to you."
Suddenly, the female's head swung back and smashed side-on into the glass, which shattered into a white spider web with a harsh crack. Sarah couldn't see through it, but she saw a shadow move, and then the second impact broke the glass free. Sarah dropped the baby on the tray and jumped back as the head crashed through and pushed several feet into the trailer. Streams of blood ran down the adult's snout from the shards of glass. But after the initial violence, it stopped and became delicate in its movements. It sniffed the baby, starting at the head, moving slowly down the body. It sniffed the cast, too, and licked it briefly with its tongue. Finally, it rested its lower jaw lightly on the baby's chest. It stayed that way for a long time, not moving. Only the eyes blinked slowly, staring at Sarah. Malcolm, lying on the floor, saw blood dripping over the edge of the counter. He started to get up, but she pushed his head back down with her hand. She whispered, "Shh."
"What's happening?" "It's feeling the heartbeat."
The Tyrannosaur grunted, opened its mouth, and gently gripped the infant between its jaws. Then it moved slowly back, out through the broken glass, carrying the baby outside. It set the baby on the ground, below their vision. It bent over, the head disappearing from view. Malcolm whispered, "Did it wake up? Is the baby awake?" "Shh!" There was a repetitive slurping sound coming from outside the trailer. It was interspersed with soft, guttural growls. Malcolm saw Sarah leaning forward, trying to see out the window. He whispered, "What's happening?" "She's licking him and pushing him with her snout." "And?" "That's all. She just keeps doing it." "What about the baby?" "Nothing. It keeps rolling over like it's dead." "How much morphine did we give him the last time?" "I don't know," he said. "How should I know?" Malcolm remained on the floor, listening to the slurping and the growling. And finally, after what seemed like an eternity, he heard a soft, high-pitched squeak.
"He's waking up. Ian, the baby's waking up."
Malcolm crawled up on his knees and looked out the window in time to see the adult carrying the baby in its jaws, walking away toward the perimeter of the clearing. "What's it doing?" "I guess, taking it back." The second adult came into view, following the first. Malcolm and Sarah watched the two tyrannosaurs move away from the trailer across the clearing. Malcolm's shoulders dropped. "That was close," he said.
"Yes,
that was close." She sighed and wiped blood from her forearm. In the high hide, Thorne pressed the radio button.
"Ian, are you there? Ian!"
Kelly said, "Maybe they turned the radio off." A light rain began to fall, pattering on the metal roof of the shed. Levine was staring through his night vision glasses toward the cliff. Lightning flashed, and Thorne said, "Can you see what the animals are doing?"
"I can," Eddie said.
It looks like they're going away." They all began to cheer. Only Levine remained silent, watching through the glasses. Thorne turned to him. "Is that right, Richard? Is everything okay?"
"Actually, I think not," Levine said. "I'm afraid we have made a serious error."
Malcolm watched the retreating tyrannosaurs through the shattered glass window. Beside him, Sarah said nothing. She never took her eyes off the animals. Rain started to fall. Water dripped from the shards of glass. Thunder rumbled in the distance, and lightning cracked harshly down, illuminating the giant animals as they moved away. At the nearest of the big trees, the adults stopped and placed the baby on the ground.
"Why are they doing that?" Sarah said. "They should be going back to the nest."
"I don't know. Maybe
the baby is dead," she said.
But no. In the next flash of lightning, they could see the baby moving. It was still alive. They could hear its high-pitched squeaking as one of the adults took the baby in its jaws and gently placed it in a fork among the high branches of a tree.
"Oh, no," Sarah said, shaking her head. "This is wrong, Ian. This is all wrong."
The female tyrannosaur remained with the baby for some moments, moving it, positioning it. Then the female turned, opened its jaws, and roared. The male tyrannosaur roared in response. And then both animals charged the trailer at full speed, racing across the clearing toward them.
"Oh my God," Sarah said.
"Brace yourself, Sarah," Malcolm shouted. "It's going to be bad." The impact was stunning, knocking them sideways through the air. Sarah screamed as she tumbled away. Malcolm hit his head and fell to the floor, seeing stars. Beneath him, the trailer rocked on its suspension with a metallic scream. The Tyrannosaurus roared and slammed into it again. He heard her shouting, "Ian! Ian!" And then the trailer crashed over onto its side. Malcolm turned away. Glassware and lab equipment smashed all around him. When he looked up, everything was cockeyed. Directly above him was the broken window the Tyrannosaur had smashed. Rain dripped through onto Malcolm's face. Lightning flashed, and then he saw a big head peering down at him and snarling. He heard the harsh scratching of the Tyrannosaur's claws on the metal side of the trailer. Then the face disappeared. A moment later, he heard them bellowing as they pushed the trailer through the dirt. He called, "Sarah!" And he saw her, somewhere behind him, just as the world spun crazily again, and the trailer was upended with a crash. Now the trailer was lying on its roof. Malcolm started crawling along the ceiling, trying to reach Sarah. He looked up at the lab equipment, locked down on the lab benches above his head. Liquid dripped onto him from a dozen sources. Something stung his shoulder. He heard a hiss and realized it must be acid. Somewhere in the darkness ahead, Sarah was groaning. Lightning flashed again, and Malcolm saw her, lying crumpled near the accordion junction that connected the two trailers. That junction was twisted almost shut, which must mean that the second trailer was still upright. It was crazy. Everything was crazy. Outside, the Tyrannosaurs roared, and he heard a muffled explosion. They were biting the tires. He thought, too bad they don't bite into the battery cable. That'd give them a real surprise. Suddenly, the Tyrannosaurs slammed into the trailer again, knocking it laterally along the clearing. As soon as it stopped, they slammed again. The trailer lurched sideways. By then, he had reached Sarah. She threw her arms around him. "Ian," she said. The whole left half of her face was dark. When the lightning flashed, he saw it was covered in blood. "Are you okay?"
"I'm fine," she said.
With the back of her hand, she wiped blood out of her eye.
"Can you see what it is?"
In another lightning flash, he saw the glint of a large chunk of glass embedded near her hairline. He pulled it out and pressed his hand against the sudden gush of blood. They were in the kitchen. He reached up toward the stove and pulled down a dish towel. He held it against her head and watched the cloth darken. "Does it hurt?"
"It's okay."
"I think it's not too bad," he said. Outside, the Tyrannosaurs roared in the night.
"What are they doing?" she said.
Her voice was dull. The Tyrannosaurs slammed into the trailer again. With this impact, the trailer seemed to move a lot more than before, sliding sideways and down. Sliding down. "They're pushing us," he said.
"Where, Ian?"
"To the edge of the clearing." The Tyrannosaurs slammed again, and the trailer moved farther. "They're pushing us over the cliff." The cliff was 500 feet of sheer rock, straight down to the valley below. They'd never survive the fall. She held the dish towel with her own hand, pushing his hand away.
"Do something."
"Yeah. Okay," he said. He moved away from her, bracing for the next impact. He didn't know what to do. He had no idea what to do. The trailer was upside down, and everything was crazy. His shoulder burned, and he could smell the acid eating his shirt. Or maybe it was his flesh. It burned a lot. The whole trailer was dark. All the power was out. There was glass everywhere, and he... All the power was out. Malcolm started to get to his feet, but the next impact flung him sideways, and he fell hard, slamming his head against the refrigerator. The door swung open, and cartons of cold milk, glass bottles, crashed down on him. But there was no light from the refrigerator, because all the power was out. Lying on his back, Malcolm looked out the window and saw the big foot of a Tyrannosaurus standing in the grass.
Lightning flashed as the foot raised to kick, and immediately the trailer moved again, sliding easily now, metal screeching, and then tilting downward.
"Oh, shit," he said.
"Ian?"
But it was too late. The whole trailer was groaning and creaking in metallic protest, and then Malcolm saw the far end sink down as the trailer slid over the cliff. It started slowly and then gathered speed, the ceiling they were lying on falling away, everything falling, Sarah falling, clutching at him as she went, and the tyrannosaurs bellowing in triumph.
"We're going over the cliff," he thought.
Not knowing what else to do, he grabbed the refrigerator door, hanging on tightly. The door was cold and slippery with moisture. The trailer tilted and fell, the metal creaking loudly. Malcolm felt his hands sliding off the white enamel, sliding, sliding. And then he lost his grip and fell free, dropping helplessly straight down toward the far end of the trailer. He saw the driver's seat rushing up to him, but before he got there, he struck something in the darkness, felt a moment of searing pain, and bent double. And slowly, gently, everything around him went black. Rain drummed on the roof of the shed and poured in a continuous sheet down the sides. Levine wiped the lenses of his glasses, then lifted them again to his eyes. He stared at the cliffs in the darkness. Arby said,
"What is it? What happened?"
"I can't tell," Levine said. It was hard to see anything in this downpour. Moments before, they had watched in horror as the two tyrannosaurs pushed the trailer toward the cliff. The large animals had done it with ease. Levine guessed the tyrannosaurs had a combined mass of 20 tons, and the trailer only weighed about 2 tons. Once they had turned it over, it slid easily over the wet grass as they pushed it with their underbellies and kicked it with their powerful leg muscles.
"Why are they doing that?" Thorne said to Levine, standing beside him.
"I suspect," he said, "that we have changed the perceived territory."
"How's that again?"
"You have to remember what we're dealing with," Levine said.
"Tyrannosaurs may show complex behavior, but most of it is instinctual. It's unthinking behavior, wired in. And territoriality is part of that instinct. The tyrannosaurs mark territory. They defend territory. It's not thinking behavior. They don't have very large brains, but they do it from instinct. All instinctive behavior has triggers, releasers for the behavior. And I'm afraid that by moving the baby, we redefine their territory to include the clearing where the baby was found. So now they're going to defend their territory by driving out the trailers." Then lightning flashed, and they all saw it in the same horrifying moment. The first trailer had gone over the cliff. It was hanging upside down in space, still connected by the accordion connector to the second trailer in the clearing above.
"That connector won't hold," Eddie shouted.
"Not long."
In the glare of lightning, they saw the tyrannosaurs up in the clearing. Methodically, they were now pushing the second trailer toward the cliff. Thorne turned to Eddie.
"I'm going," he said.
"I'll come with you," Eddie said.
"No. Stay with the kids."
"But you need..."
"Stay with the kids. We can't leave them alone."
"But Levine can..."
"No,
you stay," Thorne said.
He was already climbing down the scaffolding, slippery in drenching rain, toward the explorer below. He saw Kelly and Arby looking down at him. He jumped in the car, clicked on the ignition. He was already thinking of the distance to the clearing. It was 3 miles, maybe more. Even driving fast, it would take him 7 or 8 minutes to get there. And by then, it would be too late. He'd never make it in time. But he had to try.
Sarah Harding heard a rhythmic creaking and opened her eyes. Everything was dark. She was disoriented.
Then lightning flashed, and she stared straight down toward the valley 500 feet below. The view swung gently back and forth. She was looking through the windshield of the trailer, hanging down the side of the cliff. They were not falling anymore, but they were hanging precariously in space. She herself was lying across the driver's seat, which had broken free of its mounting and shattered a control panel in the wall. Loose wires hung out, panel indicators flickered. She was having trouble seeing from the blood in her left eye. She pulled out the tail of her shirt and ripped 2 strips of cloth. She folded one to make a compress and pressed it against the gash on her forehead. Then she tied the 2nd strip around her head to hold the compress down. The pain was intense for a moment. She gritted her teeth until it faded. From somewhere above her, she felt a thumping vibration. She turned and looked straight up. She saw the whole length of the trailer suspended vertically. Malcolm was 10 feet above her, bent over a lab table, not moving.
"Ian," she said.
He didn't answer. He didn't move. The trailer shuddered again, creaking under a dull impact. And then Harding realized what was happening. The 1st trailer was dangling straight down the cliff face, swinging freely in space. But it was still connected to the 2nd trailer, up on the clearing. The 1st trailer now hung from the accordion connector. And the tyrannosaurs, up above, were now